You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And welcome, everyone, to Rock M Radio. This is a brand new episode of Dive Cuts. We're on season 7 here to talk all about your Missouri basketball Tigers. I am back, your host, usual host, not last week, Sam Snelling. I'm here, if you're watching on YouTube, I am the guy on the left side of the screen. On the right is my good friend Matt, who stepped in for me last week as I helped celebrate my wife's birthday. Matt, how'd it go last night? How was your podcast host experience?
It was very well scripted and also very metaphysical in our outlook on Missouri basketball. It went well. I hope you and your wife had a lovely time in lieu of joining us. I'm sure eating a nice meal with the one closest to you, Trumps, discussing this particular season of basketball and brand of basketball that we're watching, but it was good. It was good. Now I just wish it was a little bit warmer. We're about ready to get hit with a sheet of ice overnight here in Indianapolis. So, you know, different kinds of stress are coming.
Yeah, you're on the back end of what we just got. So we are recording this Monday, January 22nd. If you're in the St. Louis area like I am, then you were probably stuck at home for most of the day today. There was a lot of ice. It was unpleasant. And watch this segue. There was a lot of ice at Mizzou Arena on Saturday as the Tigers took on the Florida Gators. Brick City, ice cold shooting. Missouri just can't seem to catch a break. They had Tamar Bates go for 36 points. Just an absolute awesome performance from Tamar Bates.
Oh,
and
fun.
Virtually nothing from anybody else. It was one of the more unfortunate, like great performance timing, I guess, kind of the word that I'm looking for. Like the timing of his performance, everybody else was bad, and Missouri lost by double digits. So
you know what happened? Tamar walked in that locker room, and he saw those beautiful, beautiful retro threads hanging in the locker, and he said, "I have to do this for my forefathers. I have to go thermonuclear for Anthony Peeler, for Melvin Booker, for all those who came before me. When I put this jersey on, it's time to go off." And that he did. He paid his respects in the greatest way possible.
Well, and I was going to say, like, while he never donned the uniform himself, you know, Tamar certainly looked like a Kareem Rush clone at times with the lefty stroke.
And that in the pick and roll on the left side of the floor, it was scary. Even the little like kind of leg kick, the little like kind of extra little flip off the wrist on the finishing move at the top of the shot. It looked how he hangs a little bit at the top of that jumper.
Yeah.
The vibes were very strong. Very, very strong.
Yeah, it was really fun watching him. So this is coming off, I guess, another Ofer week for the Tigers. They lost to Alabama on Tuesday. That was a little bit to be expected, obviously, mm-hmm. with the Tide. You know, they're a top 10 in KenPom. They score the ball really well, something that Missouri doesn't necessarily do consistently enough. The Tide, they don't always defend all that well, and I think that's one of the things that Missouri took advantage of and we're able to kind of, you know, make buckets and kind of stay in the game until what would you say, like about 5 or 6 minutes left when Rylan Griffin kind of went off. And so I think, you know, kind of coming into the Florida game, I think we were hoping, at least I was, that they would just kind of have one of those nights. Like this is something that happened like during the Kim Anderson era, during the Constant Martin, you know, bad seasons. They would just have a couple performances in there when everything just sort of worked for them, and they won. For Kim Anderson, it seemed to happen a lot on the Rally for Ryan games. You know, so but it's just like one of those games where, like, you know, you kind of get a couple of those made threes early. You know, the confidence starts to build. You get, you know, guys like Noah, Nick involved, and then you get, you know, Sean East able to kind of break guys down. And then, you know, the subs come in and they make a few shots that they don't normally. You know, all the shots were basically just going to Tamar as far as the makes go. And it just, you know, they started 0-for-5 from 3.
Yeah.
They never seemed to, I think at one point they'd kind of made 2 in a row, but I think it was Tamar and Nick that hit those two. Honor made 1 more 3. It is nice seeing Nick kind of, you know, get back on track for what I think we're accustomed to with him, but just no support for Tamar whatsoever.
No. You know, we were talking about it before we came on, and you know, about where guys' ceilings are, you know, when they're vets, and you know, how much, you know, sort of headroom is left. And I think early on in the year, we were seeing Sean East, and what excited people was we were seeing Sean East really, I think, come close to getting back to kind of, you know, the top end of his skill curve, you know, based on, you know, last season on transitioning, on his role, on maybe tweaking his shot during the season. It just wasn't great for him, but, you know, he sort of made up for lost time early on in non-con. And I think a lot of people thought, here's a guy now that's going to, you know, really do something kind of, you know, transformational. He's going to really, you know, up his production. He's going to become a guy for Missouri. But, you know, we even saw at the end of non-con that, you know, the scouts started to get out on him, particularly in side ball screens on the empty side of the floor. You know, teams have started hard hedging him. They started icing. They started trapping him in those situations. You know, a lot of what Sean has to do is kind of dominate the ball and probe, and that can bottle things up. It can throw off, you know, when you need to cut. It can throw things off schedule a little bit. And, you know, you get into SEC play where teams know you and your personnel even better, it gets even harder. And I think we're seeing that now with Sean in the past 3 games. I think the scout was already out, and I think it's really been crystallized now, and it's been hard for him to really get some of the spots and actions and situations that really make him, you know, sort of potent. Noah had been shooting the ball better. You know, I don't know. You know, he went 3 of 8 on Saturday. You know, maybe another rim making and a 3-pointer dropping to go 5 of 8 was probably all that was really needed. That would have gotten it to 7. A typical-ish day for, you know, Sean probably gets you in the ballpark. And, you know, I think as we can talk about, there's just not, you know, a lot of reserve offense, you know, down the rotational sort of pecking order here. A nice moment.
Yeah, that's sort of the thing is, like, once you get past
There's four guys, and they're not all clicking at the same time.
It's, right. Like, you know, what, once you get past those four, I mean, who do you have taking shots? I mean, so Tamar took 21, McHonor took 5, Carter took 8, Chinese took 7. Vanover took 1, Butler took 2, Lewis took 1, Pierce took 3, Carolero took 4, Robinson took 1. Aiden Shaw did not take a shot. He was 1 of 4 from the free throw line. So, but yeah, you're basically, and if you're looking at those four, you know, these are guys who, you know, coming into the season, obviously, I think it's different than where we are now. But coming in, I think we thought Tanji was going to be productive. We thought, you know, Grill was probably going to take a good amount of shots. You know, but I think there was like some expectation that, you know, Tamar Bates was going to hopefully kind of develop more of what we were seeing from him as far as like his range in high school. But the consistency of guys last year of, you know, Nick, Sean, and Noah, I think we all sort of expected those guys to be there and be consistently, or at least consistently a part of the offense. Of, you know, whether or not they were consistent is another thing. So that's like, that's what, 7 guys, you know, so, or 6. So that's like a much broader range of guys taking what you're probably looking at about 50, you know, 45 to 55 shots a night. You know, and then if you're, you know, filtering in, a, you know, like, you know, the freshmen and all that kind of stuff, it's a much, much different outlook versus really kind of hoping that Sean, Noah, you know, Nick and Tamar all kind of have a good night at the same time.
Yeah. It, like, you can, it's going to sound laughable to some folks now, I think, you know, given where the team is sitting at this point in the season, but like Tamar's growing into kind of that reliable spot up threat to now where he's playing out of spot ups. You know, they're starting to put him in some newer actions with handoffs and some pick and rolls. He's been really good in late clock. So he's kind of filling that niche for you. Sean's, you know, shown he can flatten out some defenses and pick and rolls and create some gaps for cutters to exploit. You know, Nick has, I think, was helped as Tamar's sort of ramped up his, you know, role. It's really allowed Nick to get back to doing what he does really well, which is just sort of initiating and spacing. So I think that's a big reason why Nick's playing better, is he's getting back to more what, you know, sort of suits him and is a more of a comfort zone for him. And, you know, then Noah would sort of, you know, be a connector at the four. He'd be able to pop and exploit some defenses that sag off of him. Maybe he'd get some mismatches, but you'd start to see how all that kind of mixes together. But like you said, they don't have Caleb Grill as a reliable floor spacer to keep the gaps open. And they don't have John Tanji as a guy who can sort of, you know, bridge that 3-4 gap, who can act as a floor spacer at the 3 and an undersized 4 that can fit into some of what they do in their Princeton and triangle stuff. They just don't kind of have those two pieces which are necessary to keep the space open and give them operating room and make shots. And then the guys that can sort of do the kind of, you know, connective work for them. And it's really just, you know, forcing them, you know, to play a guy like Jesus Carrillero a lot more, because, you know, should Zeus be attacking out of a DHO? I'm not sure. Should Zeus be the guy that's, you know, filling behind a driver? I don't know. Or should he be a guy that's attacking baseline, trying to finish over a Tyrese Samuel? I don't know, but the circumstances have forced him to have to do that. And so I get why people are frustrated, you know, when they see, you know, Zeus playing that sort of role. But my question is, who else is going to do that for them? You know, Trent Pierce is not a connector at the four. He's not able to help you run some of your offense to generate shots. The kinds of sets that were getting them shots at Alabama are getting them shots on Saturday. Trent's not ready for that. So you almost got to play Zeus in some periods just to keep the offense functioning. You know, it's, you know, I would like, you know, some people would complain, you know, about Connor Vanover being out there. Well, Jordan Butler's not quite ready offensively. No, he had a nice drive on Saturday, but other than that, he was a non-factor and he's still kind of abused a little bit defensively. They're just, there are, if there were other alternatives on the bench, I'm sure they would be going to them, but they don't have that right now. And, you know, it's, we can, we'll talk about A&M in a little bit and kind of what's waiting there, but you know, this team is what it is at this point, and they're really just having to hope that they can get a night, like you said, where the four of these guys are able to play well enough as a collective unit to give themselves a chance to close late, and they just haven't been able to do that. So it's, it is what it is. But I think the Florida game was probably more frustrating for me than the Alabama game at the end of the day. But you know, we can sort of parse that a little bit more if you want.
Well, I was kind of frustrated watching it because, you know, you do sort of see, you know, Bates giving this Herculean effort, and all, like, I really feel like there was a long period of time where all Mizzou needed was just to see a few threes go down. And whether that was, you know, I really think they would have benefited from making, you know, just a couple early. You know, because I really thought, if you go back and you watch like the first 10 minutes of the game, and I even said this in study hall, like, if you just showed somebody filming the game and you just cut out the part where guys were, you know, like the very end of the shot where it went in or not, I guarantee, like, you would go back and you would think that Missouri would you know, be ahead by 10. Like, they were outplaying Florida by a fair margin. You know, the Gators withstood the attack because they made threes, and they made some really tough threes. And like, this is one of those, like, really, really frustrating things. And I think, like, Alex Condon was the one who, you know, hit the one at the buzzer, right? When it's just like, you're like, that is just a microcosm of kind of like all the things that Missouri had working against them, especially in this game where you're doing everything right. They had maybe their best defensive possession, you know, of several games. Like, I was just thinking, like, man, they're doing, like, the rotations on point. They're digging out of the post. Like, they you know, pop the ball loose and it goes right to Condon, who hits a fadeaway three at the top of the key as time expires in the shot clock. And you're just like, you know, and it's just like, I felt at that point that they were going to lose the game, and it was just going to be one of those frustrating affairs. And it turned out to be that.
It was the same thing in the second half. There's one where Trent does a good job sitting down and staying in front of Riley. It's a late clock three. Riley Kugel, I think there's 8 seconds left in the shot clock. Riley's like right on the edge of the oval tiger head and pulls, splash. Like, it's a contested step back three from 28 feet and it drops. Like, you take those two makes off the board, it's a 6-point ball game. You know, and I thought defensively, you know, they had a really good scout. I thought they did a really, really great job of not just having a game plan, but even in-game adjustments were really, really good. And guys were mostly executing the in-game adjustments. And, you know, there's a certain point, you know, where, you know, I think Florida has two or three guarded threes that are tough, tough makes, and they drop. And Missouri has, I think, three or four open, unguarded threes.
Open, yeah.
Unguarded. That clank. And, you know, it's, I always,
from,
you know,
from guys who, like, realistically, like, should be making threes. Like, you know, like, Noah Carter had one or two really, like, really good 3-point looks. Tamar Bates has been a great shooter. All, like, corners. I mean, he was awesome. Corners. He was 1 of 4 from deep. Yeah.
There was a corner three that rattled out for him. First possession of the game, rattled in and out. It, and so I think that's been the hardest thing here, is like, to critique, you know, you and I always, I think, try and be measured in our criticism of defense, because Missouri scout was really good. Like, if you're going to ask me what the best way to beat Florida is, it's to take their backcourt out of the game. And you ran through the shooting stats before we came on air. They mostly limited the guards. Florida was average-ish inside the arc. It, like,
well, yes. So let's, I mean, I'll rattle them off now. So, since we did talk about that off air. So Pullen was 2 of 6, 11 points. Clayton, 4 of 11. He had 15 points. Richard was 4 of 11. for 13 points, and Kugel was 3 of 8 for 8 points.
The job is to stop them, is to stop Clayton and Pullen from breaking you down in ball screens and then playing out of it. Missouri trapped them, and they forced Tyree Samuel and Micah Hanlickton to roll and make catches at the top of the key and play out of it. That is a bet you're willing to take. And early on, it really, really stunted Florida. It bothered them. They put Condon in. They had to start inserting some guys to counter that. Missouri then dropped out of it and began, you know, playing some different pick and roll coverages. When Florida started figuring out how to attack, you know, those tweaks in coverage, Missouri went zone. When Florida started figuring out how to screen the zone, Missouri began token pressing into the zone to make Florida have to speed up and take quicker shots. Like, the scout was good. The execution early on was good. The in-game adjustments to counter what Florida were doing was good. Florida hit 3 or 4 guarded threes that are tough makes. Missouri didn't hit open threes. Like, that's your ball game. Like, if you're going to ask me, do I want Tyree Samuel and Mike Hanlickton to be the one that have to beat me? Yes. Yes. You know, Florida won the glass, but we expected them to win the glass, and they made enough shots. It's just like, there's, at the end of the day, sometimes it's not incompetence. It's just execution. At some point, you have to put it on the players to go out and, you know, execute and do what they have to do. And that didn't happen.
And their bigs were 7 of 14 from the free throw line.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
So Samuel was 7 of 12. Hamilton was 0 for 2.
A typical day for Noah Card and a typical day for Sean East, as this is a one possession game in the home stretch.
And I had the numbers in study hall. Like, the guards did shoot the ball reasonably well from outside. So as a team, Florida was 9 of 22 from 3. They shot 47% from inside the arc, and like, so the 16 2-point makes, 10 of those were from Samuel and Hanlickton, and one of them was Condon. Kugel was 1 of 5. Richard was 2 of 4. Clayton was 1 of 5. Pullen was 1 of 2. Like, that's where your defense actually like
matters is
inside the arc. And I realize, yeah, sometimes guys get open shots and they make them. That's usually bad defense, but yeah, it's frustrating. Cause it's just like, you want them to get off the, you know, off this losing streak. You want them to win. You want them to like start feeling better about this season. It's been a really long slog since Caleb Grill went down, and here is a game where they did everything they were supposed to do. Florida just made threes and Mizzou didn't.
Like, Missouri did a better job defending Florida inside the arc than Kentucky, Baylor, and Virginia. didn't make shots. And Alabama did not have that problem. Alabama made everything it put up. I don't know how much you want to talk about the Bama game.
We don't have to talk about the Bama game.
I mean, that I'll just say sliding door moment is Zeus missing a dunk off a turnover at 9-12. You can make a pretty compelling argument that if Zeus flushes that, it's a tie ball game about a minute later. And I think that changes some stuff from there. There were some defensive breakdowns, but there was a moment, I think, at 9-12 where you could have really started to apply some game pressure, gotten your guys some confidence. Doesn't happen. Bama comes down. It becomes a 4-point swing. There's a media timeout, and Bama just goes off. Just as Watkins, you know, I think Matt Watkins, our colleague, you know, very well documented last week, Missouri's had problems inside the last 8 to 10 minutes of ball games at closing. Kind of the same thing happened against Florida. You know, maybe this is a week where they find a little bit of a reprieve in the last 10 minutes of a basketball game where they've actually played pretty well. Like I looked at it today. If you look at the garbage time math, the typical outcome for Missouri in the last 8 games has been trailing by 7 with 2:35 left. That's when garbage time. Like, that's like, people say this team's as bad as Zoe's result and everything else. I was looking at the garbage time in Zoe. Garbage time was starting well before the 2-minute mark during Zoe's final season, quite a bit. This team is gritting its teeth. They're trying to fight. They're trying to manufacture ways to stay in games. And they just don't have the pieces behind these 4 guys to get it done. Now, maybe that changes this week, but, you know, if you're really watching, you're really paying attention, you can see they're fighting, they're trying to give themselves chances, and they just don't have either the necessary energy left because they're having to play guys a lot, or they just don't have the well of talent to really make a push and get over the hump late. It's the exact opposite of what we saw last year.
So, tomorrow night, again, this is Monday, we're recording this, so tomorrow they're at Texas A&M. For a team that doesn't rebound the ball very well,
this is terrifying.
This might make for a long night. And like, realistically, like, even Mizzou last year, who obviously much better version of the Missouri Tigers, couldn't beat Texas A&M. And the Aggies are largely the same team as they were. Like, you know, we were kind of talking, you know, before the air, and we can kind of revisit, but, you know, when you return everybody, and A&M returned everybody except for Dexter Dennis, who was one of their starters.
And Julius Marble.
Marble also. He was supposed to come back, but he's dealing with some university issue. Like, there's some there. It's been very vague. Regardless, from a statistical standpoint, A&M is very, very close to the team that they were a year ago. They just a little bit less luck in the end of some games. They've lost some close games. I think you said they were, what, 1-5?
And 1-4 in games decided by 2 possessions.
So they're close. They're very, very close. And, you know, sometimes, like, that can be, like, not having Marble. That can be, you know, like, the consistent shooting that you know, Dennis provides. Because that is one area where A&M has really, really struggled this year is shooting the basketball. All those three-point misses. Well, yeah, Hefner. He is not afraid of putting it up despite his shooting struggles. He's still confident that he's gonna make it. So like, if you're looking at a possibility of kind of getting in the win column, I'm not gonna say it's impossible because there's no such thing. A&M is a 83% chance to win. That is 17%. That's basically, like, you know, like, it's better than, you know, almost 1 out of 5, right?
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
Just go down there, shoot 85% from three, and win. Like, I just, how about we do that?
Yeah, I mean, the Aggies stink at shooting, but they stunk at shooting last year. I mean, they weren't great in transition last year, despite forcing a lot of turnovers. They're worse in transition this year. You know, Jace Carter kind of looks like the same frame as Dexter Dennis, but he's in no way been an equal or adequate replacement. Hayden Hefner is a guy who gets minutes so he can bang in shots, and he's not banging in shots. So they got a black hole on the wing. You know, Wade Taylor can shoot you in or out of a game, depending on the night. You know, so, but the Aggies, again, are like, they just have a survivalist kind of approach to basketball. When Hefner or Jace Carter bricks a shot, four guys are going to go get on the glass and put it back. You know, they do not turn the ball over. So, you know, you can't bleed them out of possessions. And the thing about this team is A&M has a really, really great, you know, pick and roll threat in Wade Taylor. And it's got a really, really good screener roller big in Henry Coleman. So I'm terrified of what they're going to do with Henry Coleman tomorrow night, because you can roll him. You can pop him. If you play him off, he can, you know, find little creases and get in and, you know, finish as a cutter. So teams have done that to Missouri. They've just come down and they've run a false action to get a switch and get Sean East low on the back line. Then they'll run a primary PNR to target up Nick, who gets stuck going over the top. And then you have a roller that doesn't get tagged. And if that's Henry Coleman, it's going to be bad news. And if Henry doesn't finish, Anderson, Garcia, or Boots Radford's going to come flying in to try and get a put back. And if Missouri can't keep him off the glass, it's probably not going to matter. So, like, and, you know, at a minimum, A&M can probably limit Missouri to one and done, and they'll just grind Missouri into paste. Like, that's the reasonable outcome here. You know, to me, I think what's going to matter here is, you know, can Missouri either one, make threes, which, you know, 40%+ would be welcome, or two, can they find a way? They are the best, you know, team in the SEC at forcing turnovers. Can they find a way to generate anything in transition? Can they generate some turnovers? Can they shoot 35% from three? And can they keep it within respectable, you know, margins on the glass? You know, that's really the hope here. And then, you know, Mizzou's got Tamar Bates, who's playing better than Wade Taylor, you know, right now. Can you get late and can you turn it over to Tamar and say, hey, Tamar, carry us home? Like, that's, I think, where you're going to be tomorrow night. That does not sound like compelling viewing. We're going to tune in and watch it. But I think that's the reality here is, you know, A&M's bad at offense. Missouri's bad at defense. Something's going to, you know, win out here. We'll see what it is. But there's a path.
So A&M is bad at shooting. Their offense is efficient because they're the number one offensive rebounding team in the country. And when you give even a bad shooting team enough opportunities, they are going to eventually put it in.
Yeah.
So, it is like, it is one of these things where, I mean, I don't really think confidence is probably going to be very high, at least from the fans. If you want to feel somewhat positive about it, like, Missouri has not been intimidated by road environments. Like,
they're not going back, blown out. They're not getting blown off the floor. You know, I think that was the, again, we talk about, people that want to compare this to what we saw a couple of years ago. Missouri has fought back, you know, when Kentucky threatened to put them out at the under 12 timeout, when Alabama threatened to put them down at the under 12 timeout. You know, they've rallied back from 18 down against Georgia. They do fight, they do scrap, they do claw, they hang in. You know, they found a way for long stretches against, you know, Florida to keep that thing within 5 to 6 points. So they have shown a propensity to make this thing competitive and to, you know, be a sit and kick team going into the under 8 timeout in the second half. the question here is, can they find enough competence and confidence in those last 8 minutes to get over? But like I said, this is a team that, you know, the median outcome right now is for them to be down 6 or 7 with 2.5 minutes to go. They just haven't been able to find enough execution over 5.5 minutes in these games to get off the schneid. But they're competing, they're playing hard, they're finding a way to hang in games. And I think that's, you know, again, people are going to hate moral victories. They're going to hate what the record is. They're going to scoff and say, this is, you know, we're making excuses for a bad team, but they're not packing it in. If they can get a little bit of competence in the last 5 minutes of some ball games, they can at least start to turn this and try, you know, keep the vibes confident enough and keep playing hard to the end. But they're not mailing it in. They're not packing it in. They're not giving it up, you know, within the first 8 minutes and going home. They're playing and they're trying. It's just, you know, as we've talked about, you know, the depth, you know, the consistency of what they have just isn't what they thought they were going to have. But they've got to find a way to, you know, MacGyver it and try and get through. But, you know, they're trying and they're really playing with effort and grit and, you know, tenacity. It's just at some point it comes down to, you know, what do you have on the roster? And they just don't have enough right now. But we'll see if they can find a way to get over tomorrow night.
And then Saturday, South Carolina, a team that you should have beaten the first time around. You know, realistically, they did not trail in the second half. Should have been able to hold them off. They didn't. So can you go into Colonial Life Arena, which, you know, I'm sure the fans are excited about South Carolina not being awful. But that place is not always known as being the most intimidating environments. They are also the Gamecocks playing Kentucky as their midweek game. And so, like, you do have to, you know, kind of wonder, is there going to be a little bit of a letdown? Is that, you know, like, you're basically coming off of Kentucky, whether or not they win or lose that game, you know, the energy in the building is going to be a lot different than it will be for, the, you know, the Wildcats. So, I, you know, like, that's a very interesting game for me. Obviously, like, you know, South Carolina is playing a lot better than I think a lot of people expect them to be. You know, they are playing, I think, the way, you know, Lamont Paris, like, wants to play. It's a little bit of a herky-jerky, you know, game when you play them, and you just have to be able to execute a little bit more. And I, you know, like, I'd say it's a whole lot more likely, and even the KenPom odds give them a 1-4 chance versus like 1-6.
It's exceptionally rare for teams to go 0-7. I mean, history says they'll pick up a win this week. Like, in one of these games, history suggests that they'll pick up a win. Like, let's hope. I mean, you hope, or else you're really starting to just get to an outlier level outcome where it's just absurd. But, you know, this is, you know, I think when I wrote at the beginning of the new year that, you know, late January is sort of when we were going to have an idea of what this team is. Well, that's here in 7 days. It's, you know, the last 10 games for teams is, you know, that commonly sort of, you know, considered the home stretch. It's when, you know, you want to be playing your best basketball. It's when you want to be able to put a good argument forward to a tournament committee. You know, this is really it. You know, the last month of the season is, you know, the last 5 weeks come after this. So it's, we're starting to get to a point where I think, you know, and I'm not going to rehash the conversation Watkins and I had last week, this really feels like the last stand of last stands for doing things the way you've done them. You know, for rotation decisions that have been made with an eye towards keeping you competitive, towards, you know, still being able to tell vets we're playing for something. But if you are 0-7, at, you know, at the end of the week, it really becomes a discussion then about what we're playing for now is not in March. It's for next November. It's for the seasons to come after that. So this really feels like kind of the last bid for this group of vets to really salvage, you know, what they want to do this season, even if it's not an NCAA tournament, even if it's not an NIT, but just, you know, to play competitive basketball and not have a program, you know, begin to shift its outlook. This is when you have to make that case. So we'll see what they do. But, you know, I think we're reaching a point where, you know, you're going to have to really make some dramatic shifts if results don't break their way this week. There won't be any more sort of, I think, concessions that could be made.
Yeah. This is looking at 2015. That team lost 13 in a row, but they started SEC play with a win before losing 13 in a row. And then 2016 started 0-1. Won game number two, thanks Bruce Pearl trying to rebuild Auburn, and then lost the next nine games.
Yeah.
2017, they started 0-9.
These are the teams in the last five seasons that have started at least 0-6.
You got the spreadsheet.
Yeah, I do.
The last five seasons. So that goes back to second year, third year?
I left out it's 2018, 19, 20, 22, and 23. I left out the COVID year because schedules were weird. And Texas A&M played eight SEC games. So I left out the COVID year. So in 18, 19, 20, 22, and 23, just three teams have started 0-6 in SEC play. And only six have started 0-5. So Missouri's in that group. Realistically, you start to, you know, see a shift right about now. But the only 0-5 team, yeah, it was Vanderbilt that went 0-18, started 0-6. The Georgia team that went 1-17 started 0-6. I think one other one in there. So it's exceptionally rare. Start 0-6, 0-7 is even more rare. If you're 0-7, you're basically the 13th or 14th seed in the SEC tournament. So when I say that this is sort of the week to make a last stand, if you're one of the vets in this rotation, you know, coaches will always want to be competitive, players will want to be competitive, but reality really does arrive this week potentially. So if you're gonna try and, you know, triage and stall for more time, this is your week, guys. Otherwise, there's not really a good argument from a competitive standpoint to keep going and doing what you're doing. Uplifting thoughts here.
It is uplifting. Missouri still has a top five recruiting class coming in, Honor Batang. The leader of that class got his rating bumped by 247 Sports. He is now the 25th ranked player in the country. That is 247's ranking. That is not a composite rating. He is a consensus five-star, or I guess not consensus, composite five-star is how I should phrase that, correct? A composite five-star recruit. Along with Marcus Allen, Trent Burns, Teo Barrett, Peyton Marshall. Almost forgot big Pate. All hitting campus next year. We're going to have a lot of fun looking at the transfer portal. Look, this season has not been fun. You know, it looked like they were maybe kind of turning a corner, and then they lost Caleb Krill. And sometimes, like, this is the kind of crap that happens. And I, for one, am completely okay having a crap season, but having a coach and a staff behind him who are recruiting the way that Missouri is, because I do think that, you know, Dennis Gates has proven when he has the talent, that he is going to field a very, very competitive basketball team. And so I am excited, regardless of, I mean, maybe I'm not excited to watch Texas A&M and Missouri play basketball. I'm never excited to watch Texas A&M play basketball. It is a brutal, brutal sport to watch. But I'm excited, to watch these freshmen continue to grow and mature. I'm excited, for Dennis Gates to continue to grow and mature. I think, he's still got a lot of growth and he's going to undergo that. Like, I think Missouri has the right guy. I really do. It's just, season has not been fun, and future seasons will likely be more fun.
Yeah. Honor Batang, you can now say he's a consensus top 30 prospect. You can say that.
Hey.
A composite five-star consensus top 30 prospect is what you could say. Watkins has been deep in,
the verdict has been on hiatus, but it's coming back in a whirlwind.
Treatise is the best way to say it. Watkins has looked at this in, more granular detail that even makes me sort of terrified. But, we know how Missouri wants to play, as Watkins will greatly detail in the coming, weeks. We know what Dennis Gates is, model is. We know what they need going into the portal next spring. We know what kind of talent they have coming in. This is, this is a disappointing near-term result. There's no other way around it. There's no couching it. But they're bringing in, a clear talent upgrade, for future seasons. They know what they absolutely need in the portal, and they can, begin to attack that now.
And I would also say, what a learning experience. your first full, real full off season, I think there are things that you definitely learn, and I think they did learn as a staff on sort of what you can and can't and can't do as far as transfer portal is concerned. And I think, as things, continue to sort of be transfer portal focused every spring, I think, the experience that they had last year is going to teach them a lot on how to approach it this year.
Yeah. And, we talked about a couple weeks ago, or Arkansas, Muss is considered the master of the portal. The two biggest fallers in terms of from preseason rankings are Missouri, but Arkansas has had a worse drop.
First in KenPom currently.
They opened the year, I think. They opened the year at 15.
14.
14. They opened the year at 14 or 15. So they have dropped almost 90 spots, and Muss is supposedly infallible in the portal. That is his milieu. That is what he does. So it can go sideways on you, and it can go poorly. And, Missouri last year, Isaiah Mosley, was not readily available, but I think Kobe Brown missed a game. I don't think Demoy Hodge missed a game. I don't think Dree Golston missed a game. Noah Carter, I think, missed one game. So out of your four major cogs, I think Nick Honor missed a game. That's five missed games. That's insanely good injury luck with among three or four pros on your roster.
And Trey was hurt, but
still around.
Trey, I think, was always going to be, he was always going to be more of a role guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The big thing was. Obviously it would have helped to have Isaiah around, but the big thing was Kobe and Demoy, not having those guys consistently in the lineup and producing on a nightly basis.
If you put them on this roster, it's probably a team that at minimum right now is looking at the NIT. That's not a bold statement, but it is what it is. And if they had had a healthy John Tonji and Caleb Grill for the full freight, maybe they're fighting for an NIT bid right now.
Well, I think if Caleb Grill and John Tonji are healthy, I think you probably beat Georgia.
You probably beat South Carolina.
You definitely beat South Carolina. And you probably beat Florida.
Probably beat Jackson State, too, if you had Tonji fully available, too. So there's three or four wins that I think you can directly attribute to poor injury luck. You know, the Seton Hall game was poor. The Illinois game was poor. But outside of that, you know, three or four of these losses, I think you can directly attribute to them not having, you know, the personnel that they thought they would. Next year, you know, I don't think there will be the same leniency, at least from us, but, you know, they were handed a crap sandwich this year. So, over the next couple of weeks, what I would say is just, at least from my seat, it's about evaluating what they do in spots 5 through 10. I am closely paying attention to what the you know, incoming freshmen are doing at the high school level. They're all playing pretty well, which is good. And, you know, then you start, you know, coveting other programs' players openly. And you just say it. You know, Matt Watkins is covetous of Miles Rice. I'm covetous of Adama Ball. If Adama Ball would like to come here and take all he's learned from Herb Sendek at Santa Clara, I would welcome him. Gladly. If Billy Lang unfortunately has to file for unemployment after being dismissed from St. Joseph's, I would love if Eric Reynolds were offered a robust and healthy NIL package in Columbia. I would be ecstatic with that development. I'll say it out loud. We have a list of 50 names. It's already so that's what I'm doing, is watching the back end of this rotation, watching the freshmen, and then DV other programs' players. What a time. Just what we all want to be doing.
Well, I dropped the link into our window here as our last parting here, giving the sponsor a plug. 573tees.com/collection/rock-m. Head there. There's a couple t-shirts there you can buy. Portion of the proceeds go to support Mizzou's NIL efforts, and they need some NIL love to get somebody who can score that basketball on this basketball team next year. But you and I are going to take this as a call to wrap this up. We are back weekly. We're going to keep running these weekly. We're going to make it all the way through the basketball season and all the way up until it's officially portal season. And then we're going to dive super hard into all the portal stuff. It's going to be great. It's going to be a fun off season. Got a lot of things in the works that I'm super excited for. If you haven't already read the Rock'em Nation website today, or I think actually yesterday is when it came out, we have two new football writers. You're probably going to get introduced to Nathan Hurst here. I think they're recording before the box score. Nate Edwards is coming back, so you're going to have a podcast with two Nates on it. You know, just like last week we had, you know, two Matts on the pod. We have a strict naming policy here when it comes to hiring people. So Nathan Hurst, excited about him. Also super excited, Chad Moeller. For anybody who is familiar with Missouri football over the years may recognize his name. He was the sports information director at Mizzou for about 20 years. And he's going to write for Rock'em Nation. Like, what a coup that is to get this guy. I'm super excited about it. We're going to get Chad on maybe not this pod, but a pod, and get him talking about the glory days under Pinkel, and he's got some fun plans for podcasts down the line. I think fun things are happening at Rock'em Nation, Matt, regardless of whether or not those threes for the Missouri Tigers are falling or not.
Yep.
Any parting words?
Nope.
All right. We're going to get out of here. We'll be back next week. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. Make sure you click like, subscribe, all that stuff on YouTube. If you're listening on the podcast feed, make sure you're subscribed there. And we'll be back next week. So thank you for tuning in.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Rock M Radio, a proud partner of Fans First Sports Network. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to see more just like it beamed directly into your personal device, just click the subscribe button below. Beep. And you can find this podcast through the Apple Podcast app or for iPhone or the Google Podcast app for Android or whatever app you use to listen to your podcast. We are also available on Spotify. Just search for Rock M Radio. And if you like other sports, Fans First Sports Network is a podcast network that has coverage of all other teams, Major League Baseball, MLS, NFL, whatever you want to listen and read about. It is a great, great network full of really fantastic podcasts. So look them up and subscribe to any and all of those podcasts. Rock M Radio will be back with more episodes coming soon. Thanks.